And good afternoon, and welcome to Angel Answers with yours truly as your host, Amy Toy. And we have a special guest, Kathy Frankovich. She's going to be talking about family dynamics and roles in alcoholic families. And before we get into that, though, I have a few announcements of upcoming shows. Next week, I am so excited about this guest, Gary Gavin. He has a book called Messages from Margaret for the year 2012 and beyond. This is a really good book. I've gotten into it. It's excellent. It's a channel message from his angel Margaret, and talks about the 2012 shift and so on. So I know some listeners have expressed interest in the 2012 prophecies and shifts. So I'm excited about that. Now on the 27th, it's going to be me. I am back from hiatus, thank God. So we will have live shows. Labor Day, we'll probably have a show. And then on September 10th, we have authors Maureen McGill and Nola Davis. Their book is Live from the Other Side, and they talk about death experiences and maybe do some, readings. They're really cool ladies. I'm dealing with them. They're great ladies. On the 17th, Kathy's back with sexual abuse, and we're going to talk about that. And then 24th, we're going to have Lynn Woodland come back in. And then in October, we have Ruth Ann Mack. We have Karen No. She has a book out, and as you know, we have a couple special guests I have planned because, there's a couple guests that we're going to do pre-recorded shows. So I'm just going to kind of keep that under wraps until I get their information, and that's all set. And I'm writing a book this summer on my life. It's, I'm going to start getting that out there probably by the first of the year. So, Kathy, welcome. I'm sorry we had to get all that stuff out of the way.
No, thank you, Amy. No, all those shows sound great.
Yes. The books, there's some really great authors coming on, and I'm booking more as we're, as the shows go on. So I just want to keep this show informative and fresh and handle topics. But the alcoholic family dynamics and roles, we've touched on addictions. I've touched on codependency. Now, this is the adult children of alcoholics, maybe will go into dysfunction. So, Kathy, what is your definition of a dysfunctional family, or let me back up. Why don't you just start us off with how can it affect the family roles and so on? We're going to go into that whole spiel today.
Okay. Well, I thought that this would be a great topic to bring up because many of us did come and are still living with, alcoholic families or families where addictions are active, and we are living with the effects and we're trying to counteract the effects. So I thought that maybe we might bring some of that out. In my own life, when I found out that this is a whole body of information that people know about and that there's help for, that was a huge relief. It was like having the light turned on once I heard about how all these roles and everything play out. And it was like, got into reading some of the books. It was like, wow, someone must have been peeking in on our family household as I was growing up, because they described so many things to a T. So I thought maybe if we could do that for somebody else and maybe switch the light on, that would be a great thing. Growing up in an alcoholic family really does have profound effects on what you learn and how you relate to others and even relate to yourself. And then when I say alcoholic, we can include other addictive substances and behaviors in there, too. It might not be just alcohol. It might be some other kind of drugs or medications. It might be behaviors. It might be workaholism. I mean, if someone is in a workaholic mode, that's another way that a person would not be available to their family or their children. They would be absent, taken away that way. So then I thought we would just look at the effects. We look at the things we learn living in that environment and how it plays out later in our life, and talk about what some of the normal parenting and normal developmental needs of a child are. And then at the end, we're going to talk about how to stop living in that way and change direction and begin the healing process.
Yes, and there is hope, because when I first started my healing journey and became aware of the situation that I was brought up in, well, I kind of knew it was there, but I didn't know it was there. If that doesn't make any sense, it does, you know. But when it opens up, you just kind of think, oh, my God, you get overwhelmed. So
right. It's like having a light turned on where there was no light on the topic before. And then you see everything, and you understand it in a whole new way.
Mm-hmm.
So within the alcoholic family, you have whatever substance or whatever the person is using to mood alter or change their feelings. So it can be a substance or a behavior. And if they don't have that substance or behavior, then the person would become kind of agitated and something, you know, they just need to get another, get back to it. So you have, usually in the, we're talking about kind of a home situation with a marriage, two people. Usually one is the alcoholic or the acting, we'll call them the acting out person. And then the other one is the codependent or co-addict or whatever you want to call that person. The alcoholic is the one that gets to drink, to act out, to yell, to scream, to do whatever they feel like doing. They may spend all the family's food money on their habit, and they get to be kind of in charge. And then the other person takes on the role of caretaker and trying to smooth things over and make sure that everything looks right, at least on the outside. They'll take on all the other responsibilities, the cooking, the cleaning. You know, they'll get a job, they'll supplement the income, they'll do whatever they need to do. But their life is wrapped up in trying to keep some kind of balance or some kind of function going. They themselves have their own issues because they most likely learned all this behavior from, you know, the household they grew up in, from their parents. So anyways, what we're talking about is really multi-generational patterns of behavior and multi-generational patterns of coping and getting by that we learn. So, excuse me, we're not looking to lay blame on anybody. Because
right.
when you have all of these patterns and when you have someone who is, you know, using alcohol or another substance or behavior, that's a form of a medication. And there, I believe that most alcoholics are also adult children of alcoholics, and they're taking care of their pain that they have from their past.
Exactly. If you go back, you know, when I did some genealogy and I talked to some relatives outside of my family, you know, family of origin, I found out that, yes, there was an alcoholic, you know, active alcoholism on both sides of the family. And, yeah, it is. And they don't know what they don't know. And so they're doing the best they can.
Right.
They have, you know?
Exactly. They're just going along and living out what they learned, too. And we had talked earlier that, you know, years ago, when it was my parents' generation and even before that, there wasn't all this help and treatment and enlightened ideas about things. There was practically no treatment at all. So once you were in this pattern, you were pretty much stuck, I would say. You know, divorce was almost unheard. You know, it wasn't unheard of, but it was very uncommon, probably within the 50s and 60s, you know, when our parents were getting going. So it was a whole different time. I think we're lucky to have all the information and treatment out there and available and support that we have now. So we were still talking about the parents. And whatever path we take, we usually stay with what we're comfortable with. You know, even as kids growing up in their family, this is what we know. So as we grow older, we stay with similar dynamics because that's what we're comfortable with. That's what we know. And even if it's that we know when to duck and run, we know what's going to happen. We know when things are going to start flying. We know when the fights are going to get out of hand, and we know when to head for the hills, more or less.
Right.
But it's familiar.
It's familiar, and sometimes we attract people into our lives that have a lot of characteristics
mm-hmm.
as our parents. And we just don't know, like I said, we don't know what we don't know sometimes until you get in the same pattern. You know, like you were talking about ducking and run. I mean, my father was a rageaholic, you know. You stayed out of the line of fire. When he started shooting his mouth off, you either went outside to play or
mm-hmm.
you went up in your room and hid. You know,
right.
You just didn't want to be, you know, a target of his wrath.
That's right.
So you just don't want to go there. And I remember, you know, just avoiding as much as I could. And
mm-hmm.
my mother, you know, God bless her, she, you know, was the one that kind of took the blame or took the, you know, the abuse a lot.
She took the brunt of the rage. Probably.
She did. And
she tried to deflect
yeah.
it or diffuse it a little, but there was still all that
it's
rage
still there.
To deal with.
Yeah, mm-hmm. still damage, yeah. And then, like, yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah.
That's one example.
Yeah. And then in the family, you know, when we live with this repetitious over and over again, that's what we learn. We learned what we lived with, and then we are comfortable with that, so then we live out what we learned. We learned how relationships work, you know. We learned
mm-hmm.
how to be caretakers. We learned being over-responsible. And also we learned that what I want or need doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
So we find people who can fill that type of a gap.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if there's two alcoholic parents or one parent's an alcoholic and one might be ill,
mm-hmm.
physically or mentally, then this over-responsibility goes to the children immediately. So that's
mm-hmm.
when you have the 5-year-olds taking care of the 1-year-olds. That's when you have the 8-year-old taking care of the entire family, coming home from
right.
school, making dinner, putting in the wash and cleaning the floor.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you have
mm-hmm.
that.
Or you have a parent that confides in you as you're in an adult, and you're still maybe 8 or 9 years old confiding in you
mm-hmm.
about maybe the alcoholic's behavior. And, you know, you're like, you jump from infant to adulthood in one blink of an eye.
Yes.
And you don't have yes. that chance to have that childhood, you know.
That's exactly right. So you have two adults who have the inability to meet the child's normal developmental needs. So what we wanted to talk about were those normal needs for a minute. And so those needs vary according to the age. You know, first you have infancy. And what you need in infancy is to be, you're totally and completely helpless, need to be taken care of. You know, you need to have your food. You need to be kept comfortable and dry. You need that diaper changed. So you need constant, warm, loving care and mirroring. You need someone to look at you and smile at you, and then you know that, you know, you kind of know who you are and where you are by having a mirror, the other person's face in front of you. The other thing you learn is whether the world around you is going to be a safe place or not. The way you learn that is if when you cry for one of those needs, someone comes and treats you gently and kindly. You know that your behavior, your crying or your calling out, will bring a loving, caring person to your side. And you learn that the world is safe, and you learn that you have the power to bring care into your life. You have the power to create that outcome for yourself. And I think that is such a massive, powerful lesson to learn, and that's the first lesson that we are supposed to learn in life. What happens is if when you cry, nobody comes, or if when you cry, someone handles you roughly, drops you, puts you back in the crib and walks away, it doesn't bring about that trust in the world. So that can lead to other problems later on, but that's one of the normal developmental needs. You know, be the parent that's able to provide consistent, loving, warm, nurturing care and mirroring to that baby.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. And then next phase we wanted to talk about was toddler. That's when the child's getting a little bigger, moving around on their own, exploring things, and they begin to realize that they're separate from the mother, that they're their own person, so they like to say no, and they like to go out and check things out, go play in the dirt, pick up the worms, you know, come, and then they come back. So they still need that security, and but they need to know that they can explore, get dirty, get a little messy, but they won't be rejected. That they can come back and, you know, if they make a mistake sometimes, you know, okay, well, you shouldn't do that. Mom might get a little angry, but she's not going to reject you completely. She's not going to let you think that you are so horrible or worthless. And sometimes that's what you get in an alcoholic family because it's the multi-generational of people who didn't have their needs met. So when you have those needs, and they're going to get rejected. So that's what happens. But then, you know, the normal needs just continue as the child grows older, a little more becoming their own person, more exploring. You need always need that reinforcement, security, and, you know, a sounding board with the parent that allows you to explore what you want, what your likes or dislikes are, so that you can pursue your own life. That's the thing that doesn't usually happen.
Yeah, I know. You know, where they kind of live vicariously through you too much.
Yeah. So that's the other thing. In an alcoholic addictive family, the children often exist to meet the needs of validating the whole household, making the household look okay or look good. That's what happened in my household where I grew up. We were so trained to appear perfect on the outside. We had to be completely well-behaved all the time. There was no wild teenage years in my house. There just wasn't. And when you were kids, you had to get 100% on all your tests. And it wasn't that we just wanted to be students. We knew it was do this or else. So it's kind of like you're putting on a performance. You do things because this is what the people above you tell you to do, not necessarily because that's what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So those lessons, again, are, you know, I don't matter. My value is in what I can produce. I can handle anything. You learn you can just handle about any level of stress, and you keep handling it.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have fun.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yes,
so,
I
know, that's part of the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really have much of your own self. You don't think or feel or realize what you would like to do on your own.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of just putting on a good performance and doing as what is expected.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, you know, if you turn out not to be the perfect one, you might turn out to be the perfectly bad one. Sometimes there's two opposites.
Uh-huh.
And we had that in my family, too. They were the girls that ended up being the perfect ones. And then when my brother came along, it was time for the imperfect one. We needed a bad child in the house. And he somehow knew that that was what his role would be.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a lot of healing now, and he's doing great. But as he looks back, he realized that that was his role, to be the bad.
Yeah,
one.
I know. I was the evil child.
Yeah.
I raised hell, and you know, anything my parents wanted me to do, I did the opposite, and I told them, you know, like I just did everything opposite what they told me to do. It was like, I was the child from hell. I didn't listen to them. I was, they wanted me to ride my bike. No, I didn't do that until I was 8 or 9.
Yeah.
I didn't do the, it's like I shut down emotionally after a while. You know, I just was like, okay, I'm not going there. You guys can do your own thing. I'm going to do my own thing. So I became, you know, as I got older, I was overly responsible for myself.
Right.
So. You
well,
know,
and there is a feistiness in that, and there's a survivalist
I think it's both. I think it's both, you know.
Yeah.
I do have a, I am very mouthy. I could cut you down because my father really blasted me verbally with assaults, so I assaulted him back. I would speak very caustic, and I would just cut him in half with a, like with my tongue. I didn't care, you know, and I learned that that's how I would react. Instead of interact with people, I would react. So that was a survival mechanism for me growing up. Yeah.
Right. And then the other aspect of this that we I wanted to mention, too, is that these patterns, as we live through them, we're not aware that we're living a dysfunctional pattern because this has been the fabric of our life from day one. Whether, you know, it was to be criticized, to be told that you were wrong, you're not good enough, you're only valued if you do certain things a certain way, you don't realize that that's not how life is supposed to be. So it isn't until later that you realize that there is another way to live, and sometimes it comes later in adulthood. We were talking earlier that even as an adult, when my brother had his DWIs and he had to see a counselor, and he had to, he had to send a family member in to also talk to the counselor, and that turned out to be me. They asked me if we had abuse or anything in my house, and I said no with a straight face, when we really did have quite a bit of physical abuse and physical punishment and verbal abuse and being cut down to nothing by the rageaholic parent. I didn't recognize that even as a grown adult with a college education, because these things nobody talks about, and we don't even know to recognize these things when we're in the midst of them.
Right.
You know, it's just it's the air and that we breathe from day one. You know, it's like a fish being in the water. You know, the fish is in the water and the water's in the fish. We're in it, and we can't recognize it until
maybe a
radio show, or until a book or something comes your way that could maybe wake a person up a little bit.
Yeah, you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes
right.
I think, I mean, I knew growing up, maybe it was intuitive, maybe it was something, that I was growing up in something that was not healthy. I mean, I think my parents did try to do what they needed to do. And, you know, we went, I remember the best years of our lives growing up, and I was acting out at school, and I was between 9 or 10 or something like that. And my mother and father had to go to counseling because it was suggested. And we went for 2 years, and I'll tell you what, those were the best 2 years out of my childhood, because my parents, my dad wasn't drinking as much. My mother was really trying to be a good mom. You know, she was trying. And they just didn't know. I mean, they tried. They didn't know what they didn't know.
Right.
So, you know, and they still don't know what's really going on, you know? So.
Yeah, because it's really very major to think of how life-changing and how serious all these issues are. You know, for a parent, for my parents never, God rest their soul, never really got in touch with this. You know, as the adult children, you know, went to therapy and went to 12-step groups and what have you, they thought that we were going, they thought then we were going crazy and we were letting people put ideas in our heads, when it really was the opposite. We were finally getting clarity on what had happened and finally learning who we were after a lifetime of not being sure. It's like a lifetime of reacting to things, being a reactor, not an actor in your own life.
Yes, and you don't, you know, but as my parents stopped working on our familiar unit, our family unit there, then it went back to hell. So many points, you know, still. But I mean, you know, as you, you know, keep working on yourself and your issues, things do get, we'll get into that later, so go ahead. I'm sorry. I don't want to jump ahead.
Well, that's just the thing, too. I mean, when we work on these things, it's kind of important to stay with it and to be willing be willing to learn new things, be willing to take in the new ideas, be willing to change our paradigm so that we can create a lasting change.
Mm-hmm.
It takes more than just a superficial go at it.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we're talking about is the deep kind of inner healing where we're willing to go inside, look at what the losses were, and kind of feel the pain and then grieve it. Because,
yes.
You know, there really is grieving that can take place and needs to take place. You know, there's it's major, it's losses in life, it's lost years, it's a lost relationship. I mean, it's giving up what our expectations were of our parents. I wanted my parents to be understanding and kind, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you realize you aren't going to get that ever, then there's grief, and it's okay to have that grief, but it's also important to start to be our own parent and start to treat ourselves kindly and with respect, to learn that things that happened to us were not our fault. We were just learning survival. We were shamed. John Bradshaw, one of the major authors and therapist in recovery from an alcoholic family, he talks about toxic shame. We were made to believe that we were the mistake. We were wrong. That's toxic shaming. The other shame is, you know, legitimate shame. When you do something that's wrong and you hurt somebody or lie, then you feel shame. But we learned to feel shame just because of who we were, just because we existed.
Yeah. We existed. We caused, you know, my parents weren't expecting me. I was later in life, and my mother remarried. She was widowed, and I have two half-sisters from that marriage. And, you know, I was kind of brought in. I was like a, you know, I don't want to, I was brought in. I don't want to call it another name. And, you know, I was kind of reminded that I was not expected, and my father didn't want me. So, you know, you walk around this with this, you know, thing in your head, these thoughts that I'm unwanted, nobody wants me, you know. You just feel this because you know no other story.
Right, right. And if it's your parent that doesn't want you, that's pretty profound.
It is.
Of all the people in the world.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I got blamed for that, and then one day when I was a teenager, I remember telling my parents, you know, we were having one of our fights, you know, and all this stuff, and I said, well, I didn't choose to have sex then. My mother, I thought she was going to die, you know, because I just said, and you chose to have me, you know, and she did, and I said, you chose to stay with him, and I just kind of threw it back at her, and to this day, I get, you know, she did apologize years ago about for all the stuff that she had said to me about my father, because she did kind of poison me against him, because that was their dynamic. And she did apologize, but I remember that fight really, you know, you chose to have me.
Right. Yeah. You had nothing to do with it. You weren't asking for that. For that.
I wasn't asking for that night of pleasure. Okay?
That's right. You had nothing to do. Well, unless you did, unless it was your little angel spirit from heaven saying, I'm ready to come in now.
Well, obviously I was. I chose them as my parents for this, whatever, you know, this life path.
But that's another topic for another day. Right?
Yeah, really? And then go in there. Well, I'm writing my book now. I'm telling you, the stuff that you look back, you're like, oh, my God, I went through that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
we as children of alcoholics may have some defense mechanisms to defend against all these feelings, and that could be the perfection. We might turn into a perfectionist, knowing that when we're perfect, we can get approval. Anger, ambivalence. We might not be able to make a decision because we're so used to maybe being obedient to what's being told from those above us. Humor, the use of humor can deflect a lot of other types of emotions, the sadness and whatever. Humor, sarcasm. We might intellectualize about, you know, what's going on. have magical thinking. Oh, it'll get better when such and such changes. We might minimize it, say, oh, it's not that bad. You know, other people have it much worse. And, we may use food. Overeating can be another way of ourselves. So there's quite a few defense mechanisms that we could use. Let's see. And then there's some characteristics. Adult children guess at what normal behavior is. Adult children have difficulty following a project through from beginning to end. It may lie when it's just as easy to tell the truth. We tend to be super critical judges of ourselves. We criticize ourselves mercilessly. Don't have too much fun, take ourselves seriously, have problem with intimate relationships, seeking approval and affection from others. Also feeling that we're different than other people. You know, just thinking, you know, I'm different, something's different about me. So there's quite a bit there to work with. So oftentimes we will just repeat the whole scenario of the family home that we grew up in. We may become an alcoholic or marry an alcoholic. We continue to fix things and be hypervigilant. Now, like we said before, sometimes we have learned a lot of survival skills. You know, the feistiness, the hypervigilance can be useful, being aware of everything and multitasking. I look at nursing, the profession I went into. Hypervigilance makes you a good nurse. So I guess you can't knock everything. Some of these skills we put to good use, right? And I think a lot of the helping professions are probably filled with people like us, you know, who've learned all those skills of caretaking, being kind, doing for others. And if it takes care of us, you know, then all the more power. I know my nursing career has served me well over the years. So anyways, I think now we might mention how we might get started on a healing path. Okay? So sometimes I say to just look at your life and see what part is causing a little difficulty. What's the thread that's out of place? Because sometimes we might look at our life and say, well, this is pretty fine. Look at, I get married, we have a job, we have a house, we have this, we have that. But, you know, what is it that's not working? There's a little something going on somewhere, and when you're willing to look, you'll find what that key is. It's like a key, and I call that the thread, the golden thread that will lead into your healing, the part that's not working.
Okay.
It's also like being at a railroad crossing. Stop, look, and listen. Remember that? Stop, look, and listen at the railroad crossing. You kind of stop what you're doing. Like, okay, I got to take a break here for a second. Because sometimes we go, and we're so busy, we don't have time to think. Because we're doing. We're not stopping to notice. So you stop, and you begin to notice. You look. Let's look at this. Let's look at what my behaviors are. Let's look at what my relationships are. Let's look at where I put my energy. Let's look at what happens. Is this how I want it to be? And then listen.
Right.
We can listen inside, not listen outside, because we do enough of that, but listen to that little still small voice within and see what it tells us. It's time to start examining things. It's time to make a change. It's time to treat myself well. Okay, it's time to surround myself with people who treat me well. It's time to learn about this. I have to get some more information. I have to learn. I think I'm going to go online and look up ACOA and see what information they have out there about this. I think I'm going to look up some of those authors that wrote those books, and I'm going to get a book, and I'm going to read it. So those are all ways to start, you know?
Okay. Yeah, there's other, you know, like, I was, a counselor kind of pointed me that I was, pinpointed that I was in an alcoholic household, and I think that she kind of opened my eyes. Actually, I knew my father was an active alcoholic, but I didn't realize that my mother played a lot of roles in this relationship, too.
Right, right. It takes two to tangle, doesn't it? And my mother play the role opposite my father. And, you know, you can't say that one was the good one and one was the bad one because they were two halves of the picture. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they were. Yeah, and sometimes you don't. And I'm not placing, now let me just qualify, I'm not placing blame for what my parents didn't know. I love my parents. They tried with the best they could, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to put them down or anything. I'm just giving examples. You know, real-life examples of, you know, how this has all kind of played out in my life. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, it's played out pretty well. So, you know, and I think with parents, they do really try. My parents really did try. Like my father and my mother broke physical abuse because my dad was brought up in a very physically abusive household, and I did not have that. So he tried to break that cycle at least.
Mm-hmm.
So there was improvements, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, hopefully now as the generations go forward, we have the ability to heal more. In past generations, it was more survival. And now that we're going forward, we are hopefully able to have more knowledge, understanding, and be able to change these behaviors, learn how to interact with another person, use even simply using I statements instead of you statements. You do this, you do that.
Oh, the blame statements, yeah.
Say, I feel upset when you do this. I prefer this or I prefer that, you know, being willing to learn a new, learn some new ways to be. And these get a
mm-hmm.
little easier to do with practice. So we have to, part of the step, look and listen, even before we react to a situation, before I react to my spouse or partner who just did something to aggravate me, stop, look, listen, stop yourself before you react in the bad way and maybe shift how you react. Comes with practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes because I'm a reactor instead of interactor, I would, a friend of mine taught me to wait the 48-hour rule. She's like, 24 to 48 hours before you do anything, before you send that nasty email or text, or before you make that nasty phone call, or before you do anything, or during the fight, you know, I need to reflect on this and walk away from conflict. Because you don't want to make it worse than it is. And in that, and you know, in a rageaholic household or somebody that has a lot of, you know, the blame game, I call it the blame game because that's what, it seems like it's a game and they blame you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just kind of say, okay, I need to kind of step back here. And if they don't like it too bad, say, I want to back off before I say something I regret, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right, so. Yeah, that's the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah,
Kathy,
yesterday.
You were just going to talk about what's the different things that we can do. Like, there was different, let's get back, there's different roles for different people. Do you want to go into that a little bit and just talk about that?
Okay, okay. Sometimes,
not labeling, but in a way.
Yes, yeah, well, it gives us a way to kind of see where we might fit in the picture, and
okay.
The various authors on this topic have labeled some of the, you know, personality types that come out of an alcoholic family home, and you have
okay.
your caretaker. We touched on that already. You find it difficult to let other people make their own decisions. You have to take care of them and help them. So you need to find someone who is kind of like a project person, someone you can work on. And
they're like a work of art in process.
They're like a work in progress, and you say, "Oh, look at that work in progress. I think I'm really the person who can fix them up, and I'm just the person they need." And you know, with your love and help and guidance, they're going to turn into who they're supposed to be. So sometimes that happens,
whether they like it or not.
Whether they like it or not, usually they don't like it, and that will only go so far. You're really, in the end, you're not honoring that person's capabilities to run their own life. And they do have the capability to run their own life without you taking care of them. But anyways, that's one of those personality types. The other one is the people pleaser. You don't stand up for your rights. You don't know how to say no. You agree about anything. You keep smiling no matter how you feel. But you are just avoid conflict, and you're a people pleaser. Okay. Another one is a martyr. The martyr. That person's esteem and image is based on suffering. They are the long sufferer. They always put other people first, but they let you know how much they're suffering. I think.
If I hadn't done this for you, you wouldn't do it. And you're like, Okay, did I ask you to do it? I mean,
right. They don't ever put themselves ahead of anybody. They put themselves last. I guess my
right.
mom, I could
the
say she was one of those types. She
yeah.
wouldn't even get appropriate, she wore a lot of old clothes over and over again. She wouldn't let herself go out and buy new clothes, and maybe somebody else in the family needed something else. At dinner, they take the, sort of a leftover piece of meat where they give somebody else the better one, you know. They're just martyrs and long-time sufferers all the time. You know, the workaholic, we already talked about that. They put all their effort into working, and it looks very good on the outside. Like, say you're a workaholic and you're doing very well in your career, you look like a successful person to this to the world we live in, but you might be using that to stay away from your own inner pain. It's being busy, 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 doing the job, doing this, doing that, working overtime. It's so important, but you're really losing yourself. You're losing yourself, and you're losing your whole family that is there kind of waiting for you and wishing that you'd be there for them. And sometimes there's little cartoons like, you know, the children are all at the table with one parent and they've got the other one, a computer image of the other workaholic parent, and they prop it up at the table.
They have a photo of them, you know.
We have a picture of your mother from last week, but she's at work, so just look at that instead. You know, it sounds funny, and you have to have a little humor when you deal with all of this. You know, because if you didn't, you'd really lose it. But, I mean, that's one of the cartoons about the workaholic.
I thought the humor was my saving grace.
Yeah, that's right. You need a little humor as you go along.
Or, as you know, I get goofier, you know. You need to have as we've talked about, life gets, when you look at these things, and sometimes you get overwhelmed, and you're like, oh, my God. And it's almost like if you don't have the proper support, or if you don't have the step, the groups, or whatever, it could overwhelm you. It really can emotionally.
Right.
So,
And
you have to look at everything at once.
Hello? Amy?
Yeah, hello?
Okay, we're there.
I'm here.
My phone is clicking, but luckily they didn't disconnect us. the thing about recovery and healing that we want to say, too, is you're not alone in it. You know, you went through your childhood alone, kind of alone, just suffering through that. But when you're in recovery, you can find support and you can find like-minded people. You can find your 12-step groups to go to. If you do go online and punch in what the kind of group you're interested in, you can find groups. And within those groups, you'll find friends who are like-minded and who will support you, and you'll support them. And you could really develop a whole new circle of friends. Depending on where you come from, you might need to change a bunch of friends, you know. If your friends tended to be, you know, your drinking buddies or your what other kind of buddies. Mm-hmm. But you really want to find somebody who's well on the path to recovery, and you can build a new friendship. And I've got many friendships like that, and they're ones that will last and stand up to the test of time. The other thing we talked about that we should mention is, you know, when we go back to that family of origin, and we're in recovery and they don't understand, you know, what this whole process is. They don't, you know, look down their nose at you, think you've gone off the deep end. You know you haven't. But we can set up our own boundaries. We can set up our limits, and we can decide how much we can handle and how much we can't handle. Like, I can go visit, but I can't stay a long time. Or I can only visit on certain days. You know, you set up your own boundaries and limits in ways that will help you. Also, you make sure that you don't, by going over and visiting, you don't want to subject yourself to another round of verbal or emotional abuse or invalidation. Because sometimes with what they say, they will invalidate that you're going through this whole healing process. So so you kind of are careful about what you subject yourself to, and you have the right to do that. It's not only right, it's actually good for you to take care of yourself, because you'll develop a whole new trust in yourself that you are capable of treating yourself well, and that the world is really here to treat us well, and to treat us fairly, and to not put us down for things that we didn't do. So we can learn to set limits, boundaries, and take care of ourselves, and that's appropriate. It makes us stronger in the long run.
It does. It really does. And sometimes it's okay, and I mentioned this on my show, it's okay for you to back away from your family of origin if there are too many triggers.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to do that. People think because they're my family, and I need to, you know, I need to be, you know, the good daughter, or I got to be the good son, or my parents need me. If they are so toxic to you and you can't deal with them, it's okay for you to back away. It's okay for temporarily, or how long you need to say, hey, I need to kind of have some time. I need some healing time here.
That's right.
And people don't, you know, understand. You know, some people, they think that it should be like up your family's rear end 24/7. And sometimes it's the worst thing you can do. It all depends on where you are in your recovery and where you need to be.
Right. And
it's my two cents on that.
Right. That's the thing. You know, what was right for me to do might not be the exact right thing for somebody else to do. Like, in my recovery, I had to take a period of time, it was 8 months maybe, where I didn't speak to my mother at all. That might not be what somebody else does, but in my case, that was the exact right thing to do. Because then when I did resume contact with her, it was, the whole dynamic changed. I was then in control. It was just a whole different dynamic. I had gained so much by not subjecting myself to that constant needling and invalidation, that even just keeping to yourself for a period of time strengthens your being and strengthens your spirit inside and out, that, you know, things are going to be okay, and you can shift. It's a shifted dynamic. So that's what can happen. Now, The other thing I wanted to say is, you know, a lot of people will say, why are you digging up the past? Why? This is all done and over with.
I get that all the time.
Yeah, why dig this up? Well, because it's still active. It's not gone. It's inside of you, and it's it's directing your life. It has an active effect on you even today, whether you know it or not. It's not until you go in there, look at it, sort it out, grieve it, rage about it, have your feelings about it that you never had before, that you can diffuse it, and it will lose its grip on you. It will become neutralized. That's the point of doing the healing work, to neutralize these things. So it's like a piece of history. It's the past. It's a fact. We can't change the facts, but we can change the grip that it has on us. That's what we change by looking at it.
And I mean, to be to deny what happened in my past, or you know, somebody else's past, is right. It's invalidating what happened. It may be my perception of the way things carried out. Because you could be invalidated by, they will say, you know, maybe this family member will say, it didn't happen that way. No, that's not the way it happened. And you know darn well it happened the way you saw it. You know, everybody has a perception. There's no one right perception on how you may view something either.
Right. And depending on your age and depending on your perspective, you know, different people can have different perceptions of the same event. It doesn't matter what somebody else's perception is. It really only matters your perception. I felt hurt. I felt invalidated. I felt scared. And then that fear stayed with me, you know. So it's your feelings that are important, really. And those are the ones to deal with.
Right, because if they're not able to, the person, the family member, whoever, is not able to, you know, kind of give that to you, you have to give it to yourself. And like we talked about reparenting, you know, we reparent ourselves, and we really do. Once we are on this path, we give ourselves the approval, we give ourselves the validation, we give them ourselves the love, we give ourselves that because we have to. That little inner child is still in there.
That inner child is in there, and she's screaming, usually.
Yeah, screaming. I want my attention. I want this. You know?
Yeah.
And then you act like that little child when you're an adult, and then you're like, where the hell did this come from?
Right, and that's what Bradshaw said, too. It's a 150-pound two-year-old in an adult body who's taking care of their two-year-old, right? Because they've never worked through theirs. That's who's in charge. It's the two-year-old inside who didn't get taken care of that's having a little tantrum. Or else the child might be so withdrawn that you have to coax them out a little bit, that inner child. I'm wondering if I should mention some of the books and authors that are extremely helpful.
Yeah,
we've
got
topics.
A few minutes. Sure.
Yeah.
One
of the classic good books to read first off is called It Will Never Happen to Me by Claudia Black. That's a great one.
I've read that.
Did you read that one?
I've read that one.
That one was great.
Ago, billions of years.
It happened. Yeah. We read these in the distant past, but they are the ones that got us going. Healing the Child Within is great. The author is Charles Whitfield, W-H-I-T-F-I-E-L-D, Whitfield. That's a good starter upper book. Any of John Bradshaw's books are great. Healing the Shame That Binds You, Homecoming, those are real good. Another one, Children of Trauma, Jane Middleton Moe.
Those
are the kind of books. You go online and just look up. Pardon me?
Yeah. Just look those up, but there's one authors that helped me through mine, because my issue was attracting unavailable emotional men.
Right, emotionally unavailable people. Yeah.
Yes. And the Intimacy Struggle, Revised and Expanded for All Adults, by Janet C. And I can't pronounce her last name. WOITITZ. That's
yeah.
a really good one.
She's
I still
a good
have
one.
That on my
mm-hmm.
shelf.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. These are great ones. If we look up online, Adult Children of Alcoholics, and see the resources that are on there, that'll guide you to. I was looking at clips of that. Janet Wojtitz or whatever her name is. She's online. There's some YouTube of
yeah.
her. And there's, you know, John Bradshaw
yeah.
is online. And, you know, there's workshops that he, I don't know if he still gives them, but he's still alive out there somewhere. But, you know, he's great.
Yeah.
If anybody can get a hold of his tapes and things, those are really, really bring a lot of clarity to the whole topic. You have a good place to start off
exactly.
with. Good exercises to do.
Yeah, so any little bit can help you with this journey. And hopefully today we helped some out there who are starting their journey or maybe still on that journey and just kind of at a loss or whatever. You
mm-hmm.
know, Kathy and I been there, done that, and still working through our issues. We're on the maintenance diet, aren't we? Like,
yeah,
well,
I think we're on maintenance,
the
maintenance plan. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you never know when another wonderful healing event will take place. You kind of get through the big stuff, and then more little stuff. And it just makes it very a wonderful unfolding. It's a journey that I would trade for anything.
Yeah. Sometimes you think you're done with something, and then it hits you right upside the head a few hundred times, and you're like, no, I guess I got to look at that again in a different way.
Sometimes you have to repeat things a little bit. Yeah, that's kind of a drag sometimes, but you just have to do it, and I think you learn. You're just learning, and I think,
it's all about learning. Well, we got to wrap this hour up, Kathy, and we could go on, I feel, with this topic, which was good. I hope we helped some people today.
Yeah.
And, I will be back next week with Gary Gavin about Messages from Margaret. Really good book. If anyone wants to kind of pick that book up, it's published through Balboa Press. If I could talk today, and Kathy, thank you. You'll be back next month with another informative topic, and we'll take it from there. Okay. Thank you very much,
Amy. Thank you. It's great. Talk to you later.
Thank you, sweetheart.
Okay. Bye bye.